We are about to begin the Talmud class from Nut. Meet next Wednesday. Bezat Hashem, I will meet the following Wednesday, so 2 weeks from tonight. I expect that there will be a class. I'll be coming home from Israel that morning, and assuming that I get home as planned, and assuming that I can stay awake, we'll be on. We'll be doing it. So next week, no class, though. Next week, no class. We are on Daf Hey Amud Allah 5A2. Now, we should probably go back to 5A1 so that you remember what the discussion was that we were in the thick of. And that was that we had already taken the route of looking at two methods of Kiddushin that were mentioned in the Mishnah. First Keseth, the second one Bi'ah. That was not the order they were mentioned in the Mishnah, but that's the order in which they were dealt with here in this long Sugya that we're in the middle of. And the, more or less, the approach of the Sugya is to examine each of the methods of Kiddushin as it's defined in the Mishnah, and to say, how do we know this? Where do we learn this from? And there may be a feeble effort in the beginning to pin it on some scriptural source, but basically they start out by learning it from logic. Have a logical argument, and that is trying to see whether in fact they can prove that based on what we know, we can derive logically that these are valid methods of acquisition for marriage. In each case that we examined, the logical method failed. Eventually, the method of the Talmud is, you create a logical possibility, you knock it down. Either you then create another logical possibility, or you knock down the knockdown, which leaves you back where you started. Okay? You attack the attack, and therefore your logical presupposition still stands. Your logical supposition still stands. So, in each case, we go through this for, you know, a variety of proofs, and the logical proofs fail. And in each case, then, we find that there is a scriptural source that seems to be the way in which the argument ends. So, interestingly enough, now, this is not unusual in the Talmud, where we have a Mishnah, and the Talmud wants to know what the source of the teaching in the Mishnah is, and the source turns out now not to be logic. It's not reason that's compelling, but it's a scriptural verse that is compelling. Okay? Now, I've gotten to the third one in this sugya, and that is shtar. That is that a document, the presentation of a document, can create the relationship of marriage. And here the argument is similar. It starts, this is on 5A1, I'll do this quickly, the dinhu. This is all logical. Okay? Logical. And then we saw that it was argued that it was logical because it was compared to the situation of divorce. And since a document was able to produce divorce, a document must be able to produce marriage. Well, how logical that is, the Gemara then examines that logic, and it says, well, you can't necessarily say that, and it shows a variety of reasons why you may not really be able to go that route. All that having been done, eventually we came to a scriptural verse. Let me see. Let's see. Where is that scriptural verse? The Yatzava Hayata. Right. Okay. The verse is the Yatzava Hayata. This was the verse, as you can see, it is in note number 7, note number Seven, the Yatzah mibeito. This is a situation of divorce. She shall leave his house. V'halcha, and she shall go. V'hayata le'ish asher acher, and she shall become for another man. In other words, she shall become the wife of another man. In one verse, we see the Yatzah and the Hayata. The Yatzah referring to the previous marriage, the Hayatah referring to the next marriage. And the nature of rabbinic exegesis is such that the rabbis will not infrequently learn that if the conditions of one part of the sentence are known to be such, that similarly those conditions will apply to the second part of the sentence. So since we know that in the condition of the Yatzah, when she went out, how did she go out? There's only one way you can go out. The Mishnah has said it, you go out with a get, which is a written document. Therefore, as she goes out with a written document, she comes in with a written document. Okay? That's the logic there. I know Yatzah. Now you see Abishtar down the end of 5A1, left side, as she leaves with a document of Havayanami Bishtar. So her being, her coming in also is with a document. Right now the Gemara begins to question this Baraita, and very logically says Va'akishnami Yitzi Ala Havaya. Well, if you're going to equate these two things together, going out and coming in, we've already proved in the Talmud how a woman comes in. Namely, she comes in with kesef, with a payment of money. Right? That was the first of the methods of acquisition of a wife, with kesef. So if you're going to learn something about one half of the verse to the other half of the verse, you want me to learn from the writing that she goes out with writing, that she comes in with writing. You're going in one direction. I'll go in the other direction. What's more logical? Go in the other direction. If she comes in with money, she should go out with money. And we know already that she doesn't go out with money. So therefore, the whole effort that you have to equate the two parts of this verse and to say you can learn from one about the other doesn't work, because you should be able to go one way, you go the other way. How do you know which way to go? Uh-huh. Good argument. Amar Rabbaye, Yom Lu Kesef Machnis Kesef Motzi. Rabbaye says this is not logical. It's not logical that money would work for a divorce. We understand, we already proved that money works for marriage. But money can't work for divorce, and the reason that it gives us senegoria se kategor. Can a defender become an accuser? Namely, the thing that brings you the good, the money, delivers the goods, namely the wife. Can something that is the source of so much good be the source of so much bad? Right? It wouldn't work right. Money, so money can't be used for that. So the Mara says logically, if you want a reason like that, okay, I'll take you one better. Let's just look at the document, the side of the document. What are we using a document for? Are we using a document for divorce? What are you trying to prove here, that you can use a document also for marriage? Oh, it's the same problem. It's the same problem, because kategor now says senegor. The senegor now says kategor. The good guy becomes the bad guy. The good guy, which is the written document that brings you to marriage, becomes a bad guy, the thing that divorces. So it doesn't seem to make sense. Then the Gemara says, nearly the high star of the food, and nearly the high star of the food. Wait a minute. The words on this document are not the same as the words on that document. You are trying to tell me that I can't compare the two documents, and that because one document is, as it were, bad, and one document is good, you can't learn from one about the other. It's not true. That's not true. Because the fact that it's a document is one thing. But each document is different. One document says that you get married. The other document says that you get divorced. And the fact of it being a document isn't as significant as what is written on the document. So you can't say that this is a problem. Well, if you can't say that's a problem, hachanami. High kaspa lechud, the high kaspa lechud. Well, we could do the same thing with money. If you're going to say this document is different from that document, I'll say this money is different from that money. So how does Mariah answer that? Mariah answers and said, no, this money is not different from that money. Why? Because all money looks the same. Well, you have money, you have a dollar. A dollar is a dollar is a dollar. But a document is not a document is not a document. Every document is different. So the fact of it being a document doesn't make it the same. But the fact of it being money does make it the same. Okay? So in fact, we come to the conclusion here that there is a qualitative difference between two documents that does not exist for two pieces of money. Okay? Any questions so far?
Have two different amounts of money.
That's true. That could be. But still, the Gemara is pretty convinced that money is money. Money is money. Okay? And surely there's no such thing as an abstract kind of document. You can't just give a document. Document has to be specific to the circumstances. All right, now Rava comes and will give us another possible reason why money is not good for divorce. So we have a reason why a document is good for marriage because of that verse, the Atzava Haita. Now that we know. But why, and we're tempted to go in the other direction too. Rava will give us another reason. We can't go in the direction of comparing money in the two situations of marriage and divorce. Rava Amar Amaka Vechatavla. Scripture says, he shall write for her. That's the laws of divorce. Torah says, he shall write for her a bill of divorce. That's specifically what the Torah says. The Torah specifically says that she is divorced through writing. And because of that, it in a way is excluding other methods. Right? The Torah never really told us directly how a woman was acquired. It never really said that directly. It says, ki kach isha, if a man acquires a wife. Then we learn by comparing the use of acquire in a variety of situations, but that's one step away. We had to prove that. But here the Torah itself says explicitly, in a way that you can't miss, v'chatav la sefer kritut, he shall write for her a bill of divorce. If the Torah sets it down so specifically, it must do that, among other things, to exclude certain other things. Right? Well, what is the thing that it would most obviously exclude?
Money.
That's what Rava says. Right? The Eman b'garashet b'kesa, she does not become divorced by money. The Ema, of course the Gemara will come back now and say that the words he shall write for her really teach something else. Bichetiva mitgareshet ve'ena mitkadeshet bichetiva. We could say that the words and he shall write will tell us that he writes for her a bill of divorcement, which is to say, he writes for her only a bill of divorcement, which is to say, well, we're trying to prove that you can make a marriage as a result of writing a document is not true, because it says the chatav la sefer kritut, he shall write for her a bill of divorcement. That is as much to imply a bill of divorcement he shall write, but what should he not write? A bill of marriage. A shtar for marriage. Okay? So we keep going back and forth. And so now we're going back in the other direction. The husband, whoever the husband is, okay? The Eina Mitkareshet Bekesef. The Eina Bichetiva Mitkareshet. The Eina Mitkadeshet Bekesefa. And the Gemara answers that this approach is not really good. Why? Hakativ, it is written, V'yatzah v'hayta. She will leave and she will get married. makish, which indicates that the Torah compares being to leaving, marriage to leaving. And what we learned was the comparison between the two was the fact that there is a document in both cases. That's what we had said earlier. But then the Gemara says, Umara ita, I don't understand you. I can't see where you're going with this. Nistabraka ebegirushin mema ebegirushin. The Gemara, first of all, says, if it says on one hand that it's being excluded, as if we're excluding something, why not understand the other half excluding something? Just as we're saying we're excluding kesef from the divorce, why can't we say that we're excluding writing from the marriage? Why can't you go in two directions? So the Gemara says, Mistabraka ebegirushin ma'et gerushin. Where something is explicitly written in the scriptures in the context of divorce, it will create an exclusion in its own context, namely for divorce. Right? For divorce, it says, V'chatav la sefer kritut. That does create an exclusion, namely money. Right? You can't do money. You have to write something. So, it's obvious that if scripture is so explicit, and it's talking about divorce, it must be explicit, and any exclusions that are implicit must be vis-a-vis divorce. Okay? It doesn't work the other way around. If you want to take the idea of excluding something and learn it the other way around, that something that's excluded for marriage doesn't work for divorce, it's just not likely, because the exclusion is written in the context of divorce itself. So that's where it forces. Right? So, that's pretty good. So we're back to where we started. So far we have proven, or seem to have proven, that it makes sense to have a document for marriage just as there is a document for divorce. And the key thing was that we had a biblical verse, Yatzah v'haita, that compared the two. Questions so far?
Yes. If there is a divorce, a proper divorce, and the woman leaves the house of her husband, but she has neither a new husband nor a house of the father to go to, does the first husband not obliged to give us the money?
He is, because it's in the ketubah. Mm-hmm. There's a statutory ketubah. He is not allowed to be married to her unless she has a ketubah. And the ketubah is a promissory note which requires him to give her a certain amount of money at the termination of the marriage. There are two ways that the marriage can be terminated, either through divorce or through the death of the husband. In both those cases, that note falls due. But she has money. She
has money.
His estate. The estate has to pay her before it pays the heirs.
And
she has a first lien on the estate.
And what is the magnitude of the payment?
The magnitude of the payment is 200 zoos for a version. What?
It's a fixed payment.
It's not negotiable. Well, it is and it isn't. There is a fixed portion and then there is a negotiable portion. The fixed portion is paid first. Because I'll tell you how much it is. It's 100 goats. It's 100 goats. Because a kid which my father bought for two zuzim. Some parameters here of what they were talking about. It's a decent amount of money. I couldn't tell you how much 100 goats cost. All I can say is that in agricultural economy, it seems to me there must have been a lot of money.
But then the divorce is not completed until she receives that money?
No, the divorce is complete, but he owes her that money.
He owes it.
Right, I mean, she would be a creditor.
Right.
the divorce is not dependent on the payment of the money. He becomes a creditor as soon as that divorce is effective. He becomes a debtor. He's indebted to her. She's the creditor. He's the debtor. Yes.
Can you have a marriage without a petition?
No. You can't in two ways. One, you are obligated to have a ketubah, so that if for some reason you don't, you have to write a ketubah. That's where you lose a ketubah. Right? You have to make sure the ketubah is written. So, that on the one hand. Let us say then that you never did it. You never wrote the ketubah. Or you didn't want to write a ketubah. You forgot to write the ketubah. There isn't a ketubah. Anyway. Since the ketubah is a statutory part of marriage, the truth is that even if it's not there, it's there. Because the court has said that a marriage must have a ketubah, so that even if you don't have a document to prove it, if there are any witnesses that you were married, then all the basic stipulations of the ketubah are still in effect. Now, go back to what I said before in answer to one question that actually plays in here. You are allowed in a marriage to add stipulations to the ketubah. So that there are places in the world where Jews do that, where they add a lot of stuff to the ketubah. And it's a prenup in a way, but it's not exactly the way we think of a prenup. Usually a prenup excludes certain pieces of property. Here it has almost the opposite effect. It includes certain pieces of property. It becomes a document of dowry as well. So it can have that effect. And it can articulate the kinds of property that the woman brings into the marriage. That's important also for the dissolution of the marriage. Because a certain kind of her property remains her property, even though while they are in the marriage, he has rights to the fruits of the property. The property is protected, though. Whatever it is, if it's $10,000, it's worth $10,000, no matter whether the market goes up or down. So if that property is not left, you know, if there's nothing left of that property, he still owes her $10,000. Right? It's a fixed amount, and that's one type of property that can be entered into the ketubah. So you have issues of property that can be entered into the ketubah, and what one might call negotiated amounts of money. He may say to her, or they may negotiate this, in case of the dissolution of this marriage, because I am so much in favor of this marriage, I add another 200 sous. Right? Now let's say you do add that. You add another 200 sous. That is not included in what I call the statutory ketubah. So that if you lose the document, then you're in trouble as far as that one is concerned. Because the court has not legislated that amount of money, that's a negotiated amount of money, and you need proof for that. Okay? So that's, there is some difference as far as those amounts go in the ketubah.
Wouldn't it prevent poor people from getting married if they have the promise 200
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think so, because the worst that could happen is that they wouldn't be able to pay. Realistically. They get married and take on that responsibility, of course. And if there isn't enough money in the estate to pay that amount, then in fact, she simply paid whatever is in the estate. Let's say the estate is worth 200 zoos. Okay? And he has six children and one wife. Right? The six children get nothing, the wife gets 200 zoos. That's the way it works. It's interesting the way the law is, though. If he has 201 zoos, then they divide it in seven. But if it's 200 zoos, then she gets the whole thing. So it looks like that. If there's less than 200 zoos, she gets whatever is there. They don't get anything.
Not really directly related, but today's Jewish Telegraphic had a story about the Canadian Supreme Court and a woman who had been wanting a get for 15 years and whose husband would not give it to her, who sued the husband. She's now past childbearing age, and the Supreme Court decided today, or whenever this report was written, that he had to pay a $47,000 in damages because he wouldn't give her a get.
All right. Interesting. Well, let's so as I know, we've never had a case like that in this country.
This is
because
the
of the separation of
the
church and state. We do have, interestingly, we do have a lot of law, we have it in New York State, about the admissibility of a ketubah for certain purposes in a secular court. Ketubah is admissible in a secular court in New York State, and since probably in most states these days. It's a rather new development, but nothing goes as far as what you just said. A court would never make that decision, or at least has never, to my knowledge, ever made that decision in the United States of America.
Because it will enforce a decree, not through a contract.
Correct. That is the issue in the ketubah. The ketubah was before 1978, 1979, ketubah was never allowed into a court. You could not bring a ketubah into court for any purpose at all. And the reason for that was the separation of church and state. It was considered you're bringing in religion into a secular court, and this country not allowed. So a very interesting development occurred about 1978, I don't remember exactly. It was the result of a case in California, which was a famous Lee Marvin case, the Palimony case.
Oh, yeah.
Remember the Palimony case? Lee Marvin, the actor, was living with a woman whose name was also Marvin.
He took on the name Marvin.
But they were not married. And they... he decided to break them up. He decided that he didn't want this arrangement anymore. She was not very happy with that.
No.
So she said, well, the only way we can do it is if I get half of your earnings. So he said, you don't get half of my earnings because we're not married. So she said, well, we've been living together, and we've been operating with certain assumptions in our living together. So Lee Marvin says, show me where we got married. Because we never got married. She says, well, it was tantamount to being married. So she brought a case in California court of what was called then, some it's been developed since then, an implied contract. That you didn't need a written contract to have certain understandings comprehensible as implied by the nature of the relationship that was obvious to everybody around you. So that she said that even though it wasn't a written contract, it was an implied contract. And I remember she lost that case in California. However, simultaneous with that, the notion of the implied contract was suddenly brought into many courts. And it may have been the specifics of that case, it's frequently the case in law. Sometimes it's the specifics of a certain case, but there may be an idea that was generated by the case that might work in another court with other facts. So the notion of an implied contract seemed like a very good idea in the American courts. Woman then in New York, in Brooklyn, took her former husband to court on the following basis. They had a secular divorce, and she said that he won't give me a get. He will not give me a get. And what I want you to know is that I want to bring this ketubah into court, not as a religious document, but simply as some evidence of an implied contract. Namely, when we were married according to Jewish law, and that implied that if we would get unmarried, we would also get unmarried according to Jewish law. That lady won the case. It's one case in New York. And this was the famous Ketubah case in New York. It was at that point, this is about 1979, 1980, that for the first time the Ketubah was actually brought into a court, and it stood up because of the palimony suit of Lee Marvin and the lady he was living with. That's why you never know in this world what's going to really, you know, what really helps, which side helps what side. So it was only at that point that the Ketubah became admissible, and then New York State developed all kinds of laws. So we had a get, you know, had and still have some sort of get law in the state of New York, which until that point never had been tried. It's always been assumed. It was an issue internally in the Jewish community. It was a major reason why in the 50s. There was an effort made in the 50s to create a joint bed din between the Jewish Theological Seminary and Yeshiva University. That failed over these issues. The conservative movement, Dr. Lieberman, issued a version of the Ketubah, which has what's called the Lieberman Clause in it. And the purpose of the Lieberman Clause was to give power to the Rabbinical Assembly to be able to act as an arbitrator, give it an arbitration power to force a get, and that perhaps that arbitration power would be recognized by a state court. In my opinion, what eventually happened was that the Orthodox Ketubah, in fact, blazed the ground for the admissibility of many of these notions into the secular courts, so that practically speaking, I am not at all aware that the conservative Ketubah had any more effectiveness, not that I think it's had probably less effectiveness, than the Orthodox Ketubah in functioning in a secular court. But all of that was the result of the history from the mid-50s right through the early 1980s.
Yeah. I just wanted to go back to the text for me. I'm a little confused, maybe it's not all that important, but we've been stressing the importance to in the Zubya to finding a scriptural source for the rules and Mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
So here they have concluded that it's not reasonable that a verse which relates to divorce will exclude a case of kiddushin. In other words, that the verse that says that you will give a written bill of divorcement cannot be used to create a case that means what we know.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Because they're two different types of documents.
Right. But we actually we're ending up with the verse that is identified as the scriptural source for the rule that we are that Shtar creates the machine is a verse that deals with divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it is a verse that relates to divorce, which provides for a method of divorce, is used to include a case of kiddushin.
Correct.
That doesn't seem to me too forceful. Having determined that a verse which relates to divorce will not be used to exclude a case of kiddushin, why would we use a verse which relates to divorce to include a case of kiddushin?
Well, the not to exclude was because we said it says v'chatav la, right? And you might say that applies only in the case of divorce, right? V'chatav la, because the fact that it had to say something like that could imply that. But then we argue that that's not necessarily true. And the force of both these things appearing in one verse is that you can learn from one about the other. The only concern that we have is how much can you learn from one about the other? Or whether we can learn kesef from one about the other. The real issue here turned out to be that you can't learn kesef from kiddushin, that it can go in one direction, but it can't go in the other direction, because kesef is substantially different from the nature of the documents. These documents are different one from the other.
Well, I would concede that I lost some of the thread here, but I'm reading the course at the very end where we concluded. They say it is reasonable that this is it is reasonable that a verse which relates to divorce excludes a case of divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So divorce, so that it's reasonable that a verse which relates to divorce excludes a case of divorce. In other words, that it says the Kapavla Sefer Kitut, a verse which relates to divorce, excludes the case of divorce, meaning it's only a writing and not kesef. The divorce. They say that's reasonable. But is it reasonable, meaning but it's not reasonable, that a verse which relates to divorce, the same one, will exclude a case of kiddushin, will exclude kesef?
I would just say then, you can't go to the end of the argument and start the argument from the end. You have to start the argument from the beginning and take it through each of its steps, because each of these things is meant to just sort of counter what was immediately said before it, and therefore the whole argument has to be held together, I think has to hold together as a totality. So I give you that you can do that and see how you feel after you're comfortable with the whole argument as it develops. I think that it moves in a reasonable way. I think in every step it allows for a possibility that this argument is not as good as we thought, and eventually it concludes, well, there's no reason to exclude the previous conclusion because of the attack that was made on it. The attack really isn't as good as we thought it was. And remember, that's how it's going here. It's not necessarily proving the point, the original point, but it's disproving the attack on that original point. That's the methodology that you use. Okay, now we go on. Ula Rabbi Yossi Aglili di Apek Le Lahai Kra Lidrasha Acharina. Now we have a problem, a potential problem here. And that is that there is a certain parsimony in the use of biblical verses. By parsimony I mean, you can't just use biblical verses to prove 100 different things. If you have a particular thing that you want and that you're using, like the yatzah, the haita, and you're proving something from it, you can't go on and prove something else from it. That's the parsimony. You can prove one thing, but not two. And maybe two if there's something unusual about this, but certainly not three. Okay? Unless you have three things that are unusual with it. So here there is a rabbi, Rabbi Yossi Aglili, the Atik Leila Hai Kra. He in fact takes this biblical verse and uses it for another piece of exegesis, another interpretation. She'ena mitgareshe bechesef minale. He says, how do we learn? She'ena mitgareshe bechesef minale. From where does he know? Oh, I'm sorry. He uses that particular verse for another purpose, and if you look in the note, Rabbi Yossi Aglili expounds the verse to teach that bills of divorce may be written on any material except foods and live animals. Okay? Zechatav la sefer kritu. He has to write something for her. So the question is, what does it mean to write? Can you write on food? Let's see. Can you write on food? Say you have a cake, a birthday cake. And you take on the birthday cake and you write, you are divorced from me with this birthday cake.
Can you send an SMS?
You know why it would come up?
Because
the question is, what does it mean to write? The Torah says you shall write. And one of the issues of writing is the stability of the writing, that it's provable. What if you write with disappearing ink? Have you fulfilled the requirements of the Torah? And you can see the problems with this. Since the Torah only says, and he shall write, what if he writes it on the cake and you eat the cake? There's no proof left anymore.
Right?
So the very one of the things that in the Gittin they're trying to establish is that the very simple words of the Torah are there in order to establish a clearly demonstrable, provable document that exists and continues to exist. Okay? So that's all part of the nature of this document.
Orthodox interns and residents who were on Kol HaShabbat, they would write in this disappearing ink.
You're correct.
And they would go back after Shabbat and write it again.
Correct. Okay. It's an it's the issue of disappearing ink. The issue of a disappearing ink is an issue in the Sabbath, as far as doctors go. Well, we need to get it. There's a whole field of technology and halacha. There's an institute in Israel on technology and halacha. A variety of things. A telephone that doesn't function the way a regular telephone does, the doctors can use on Shabbat. Ink that disappears because one of the definitions of writing, as we've just established here, is its permanence. It's permanence in terms of our reasonable sense of what permanence means. So these are all ways around the law in order to be able to accomplish certain things, but at least to deal with the letter of the law in a reasonable fashion. Okay? So here, Rabbi Yossi Aglieli uses that verse in order to prove the Chatavla and then the Atzah. He learns from it that you can't write in certain in food or on an animal, a living animal, so on. So she'ena migareshet hakesef minale. So how does he learn? He's going to use that verse for another purpose, right? But he's got to learn the same thing, that you can't use money for a divorce. Where's he going to learn it from? Right? So now we'll have to find out. Amar kras sefer kritut. It says, v'chatav la sefer kritut. He shall write for her a bill of kritut, of divorcement. Okay? Sefer kritut. A book. I said a bill. It's a book of divorcement. Sefer korta ve'ein davar acher korta. Since it says a book or a bill, sefer, that is what divorces her, and nothing else divorces her. So he needed another verse, because this verse was already used by him for another purpose. So he found another way to prove that. Okay. Here, Rabbanan. Now, the question is: once we get into this kind of an analysis, we go back and forth, because the question is, Rabbanan, Hai Kritut, my Avele, what do they do with the Sefer Kritut? He uses it to interpret what the rabbis already learned from something else, that you can't use money for divorce. So, by and by, well, what do the rabbis use Sefer Kritut? They don't need it for that purpose. How do they interpret it? We'll see what they say. It is needed in order to teach the law that a divorce must be something that is koret, cuts off the relationship absolutely between the two parties. Now, look at the illustration here. It's an interesting illustration. Kedatanya, as it's taught in the Braita. Hare zegitech almanat shelo tishti yayin. A guy gets a woman a divorce, and he says that there's a condition to this divorce, and the condition is that you don't drink any wine. That you don't drink any wine. Oh, almanat shelo telchi lebet avich. The condition is that you do not visit your father in his house. Okay, so just imagine what he's doing to begin with. He's playing games. The guy's playing games. He wants to divorce her, he doesn't want to divorce her. So he says, this is, the divorce is conditional. It's most documents, you can put conditions on documents usually. So he puts a condition on the document here that says, if you drink any wine, the divorce is annulled.
Okay. That's the whole point. You must have enough of a relationship.
It's coming into all kinds of problems. 10 years later, they get married in the meantime. She marries somebody else. She has 3 children from this next person. She drinks wine. Suddenly the divorce is not effective. She's married now to 2 men. I mean, you can't do that. It's a terrible situation. So, this is in theory possible. So if he says, if he makes a condition, now, generally speaking, the law, Jewish law, likes to accept conditions on contracts because it wants you to feel free to do whatever you want to do as long as it's an agreement between two parties. So it doesn't want to regulate them if it doesn't have to absolutely regulate them. When does it have to absolutely regulate them? When the Torah says something like that. When the Torah gives you an indication that there's a problem with the condition that you're setting. Alright? And here, if you say, till you drink wine or till you go to your father's house, if this is a condition that is a perpetual condition, then this is no divorce. It's not, the paper is not worth the ink it's written on. If you say, kol shloshim yom, this is a condition that exists for 30 days, then the divorce is okay. Because, in fact, it will pass. And you might have a condition that is a temporary condition and allow something like this to still exist because it's temporary enough so that it will pass. And then the crucial thing is that we have a situation of permanence. How do you know you have to have a situation of permanence? Because it says, Sefer Karitut. Hasefer Koret, the bill cuts it off. It has to be a permanent change. And even if we give you a certain amount of leeway to create conditions, there is a clear limitation on the conditions you can do in order to protect the permanence that must be the result of the divorce. Okay? Well, remember, they drank a lot of wine. I mean, that was, it was just a part of their diet. So that's the way they lived. Yeah. So, I saw another hand somewhere. Wine was good. Nice. That's the culture that people generally drink wine. Well, the water was not so. I know the water was not too bad. I don't know whether. I'll give you a fact and you'll tell me whether it's a safety issue that's involved. Wine in the period of the Talmud was cut with water. So that it was. Wine was generally about 50-50, water and wine. So, Barry, does that make it. Doctor. Does the presence of the wine act as a disinfectant for the water? Alcohol?
I'm into self-question. There'll be some effect.
It
depends on the degree of fermentation. I have no idea what their alcohol
is. Uh-huh. I don't know either. The Talmud generally says that the reason why they cut the wine was not for the reason that I just gave. The reason why they cut the wine was because the wine was too intense. It was too strong, and therefore it had to be cut.
Yeah.
So, but I don't really know what that means because generally wine tends to be more or less the same proof. And I don't know why that is. Is that because that's what tastes best, or is that something natural process that makes most wine more or less? You don't have 86 proof wine. Why don't you have 86 proof wine? Is it because of the nature of the way grapes ferment? Or is it because it doesn't taste good, so you know the best tasting wine is whatever, I don't know, some low proof, whatever it is, compared to corn mash or gin? What did you say?
Maybe the alcohol kills the yeast when it reaches a certain concentration, but it's not.
I don't know. Yeah.
Well, what would happen then in the other fermentations, which are much more powerful?
Those are distilled.
Well, what is distilled?
Maybe concentrates, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about some other times, but in medieval times, basically drinking water was, was a no-no.
Yeah.
And most people in Europe, very few drank wine, but a lot drank beer, things that were brewable from grain, rather than grapes, because grain is so easier to grow. Than grapes, but not to be cultivated. There was a lot of it around.
Mm-hmm.
And the medieval diet, was basically bread, because it was available, and beer.
Well, that makes good sense. So if you had in medieval times, if you had a divorce, and you had made it contingent on her not drinking beer forever, it would not be a valid divorce. Okay, if it was for months, it would be okay. So the divorce would, after 1 month, would take effect. Okay?
I'm sure we can find the answer about the wine that's somewhere in Rashi, right?
Probably. Did you get my comment to you today on the internet, which you sent me on the internet? You didn't send me on the internet something? So this time I thought it was you who sent it to me. The issue came up in the minion this morning. What was that issue? I forget. It was a bit of internet research that somebody did during the day today. Oh, it was the large nun in Notzer Chesed. The reading for the fast day, you read Notzer Chesed as a large nun. So I was asked, why the large nun? Why the large nun? And somebody looked it up on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several answers on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't you. Who did it? Some faithful member of this wonderful congregation pursued it on the internet and then gave two answers about why there was a large nun. Of course, I read both answers and they were both wrong. So that's one of the things you have to know about looking things up, comes up on the internet. The internet allows everybody who has something to say. If he says it's a nun because the nun was in Haman is the last letter of Haman's name, and it's Nachash is also a nun. Somebody could have given a sermon like that once, and you might have thought it was a great sermon, you might have thought it was a terrible sermon, but once it's on the internet and it's got a nun there and you pick it up, then somebody else looks at it and says, the reason is that it's the last letter of Haman's name. I don't know the reason. That's why we were looking at it. So today was Asara B'Tevet. Yesterday it was the beginning of the attack against Jerusalem in the year 586 BCE. Beginning of the attack. The Babylonians had laid siege to the walls of the city in 586 BCE today. It's from morning till night. Sunrise to sunset. Oh, dawn to dusk. Dawn to stars.
Oh,
you just looked it up?
Well, at least
it's honest. It's giving you a correct answer. Okay? As opposed to the answers I got today.
So if you chat live, you have a live chat. Is that
answer?
Can you
answer? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, to continue.
You looked up a large nun, not a large moon.
Nun is an Indian bread.
Okay, so the rabbis, now we see that the rabbis have learned this law about the effectiveness, the need for a permanent, effective cutting off of the get. Well, that was because Rabbi Yossi Aglieri had used the verse
right, to learn what the rabbis use. Then we want to know how the rabbis use, learn, what do the rabbis use that particular verse that Rabbi Yossi Aglieri used. So now the next question is, how did Rabbi Yossi Aglieri learn what the rabbis just learned? Right, because they didn't use, he didn't have that verse to use because he had used it for the other purpose. All right, so let's see where he gets it from. Rabbi Yossi Aglieri nikare tritut kanafkale. Oh, Rabbi Yossi Aglieri learns this idea of the absolute nature of the severance of the bond from the fact that the Torah reads kritut, kritut. The Torah could have read karet, it's a simpler word,
krita,
or krita, but it has to double the tuf at the end, it has to use an unusual formulation. And whenever you have an unusual formulation, it usually offers you the opportunity for expounding an additional idea. So that's how they learned the idea that Rabbi Yossi Aglieri had learned from someplace else. And I'm sorry, Rabbi Yossi Aglieri learns this idea that the rabbis had from somewhere else. Rabbanan kareid kritut lo mashmalaho. And the rabbis, this distinction made by Rabbi Yossi Aglieri, the difference between karet and kritut, they don't learn anything from that. So that's the end of this progression of who learns this from what, and finally we have a an
answer. The rabbis learned that you can't give a bill of divorce on a birthday cake.
That you have to put the gift in.
Yeah.
I don't remember offhand. Okay. Okay. Let's see. Okay, let's go a little bit further with this. Now we know that we've come to the conclusion that we have three verses for the three ways of making Kiddushin. Okay, we've come up now with three verses. So the next thing that my Rav says, well, if that's true, that you have verses, Chada Mechada Lo Acha, you can't learn each one from the other. You can't learn one from the other. But maybe you could have learned the third one from two of the verses. Right? It still wants to pursue the root of logic. To say that, well, if you had only two verses, maybe you could have learned the third one. You didn't really need a biblical verse. So then the Gemara says, well, which one shall we derive? I just say we can take two and learn the third. What do you mean? Lo lichtov rachmana bishtar. Well, the Torah didn't have to write about a document to take in the honor. And instead the document could have been derived from the other two. Well, the commonality between the other two, they do have something in common. That is to say that these are two other methods of acquisition, namely. If we don't have shtar, we have kesef. We know that kesef, money, is a form of acquisition, numerous areas in the law. We have at least two cases where we know that sexual intercourse is a form of acquisition. One, we've learned here, marriage. The other one is the peculiar case of the Yavam and the Yavama, the levirate marriage. Well, it's a case of marriage, but it's a different type of marriage. And there, in fact, if a husband dies, has no children, has a brother, the brother has to marry the wife has to marry the brother, and that marriage, the consummation, the sexual consummation of that marriage, is what gives it the definition of marriage. So we know that there is an acquisition, both of kesef and biyah. Both are forms of acquisition. Well, there's another form of acquisition called shtar. Okay? You can have a document, and you can acquire many things by virtue of a document in the law. Not unusual. So perhaps we have two things, and we have a commonality between those two, and we can learn the third from the two. You see what's going on here? Instead of just doing plain logic, you know, of taking verses and comparing them one with another, we say we have a common thread, a lowest common denominator between two of them, and as a result of that lowest common denominator, we would learn the third. Not illogical. Okay, right? The Torah didn't have to write about a document, and we could have learned from the other two. Now, the Gemara answers by saying, Mala hana shaken hana atan meruba. It wants to now show that the two that we're learning from are significantly different than number three. Well, the two forms of acquisition, namely money and sex, are forms that give people who do them pleasure. Interesting. Right? Hana'ah. People get pleasure from getting money. They get pleasure from having sex. What kind of pleasure do you get from documents?
Right.
Yeah, lawyers may get a little bit of pleasure. Your business, you may get a certain pleasure. But it's weird. Lawyers are a very honest group of people, right? So just because they're forms of acquisition, then this is so qualitatively different between the three of them that these two that you've chosen to lump together and to learn the third one from these two do have something other that's different that a document doesn't have, nor is that they're a source of pleasure. So namely, we can't learn number three, we can't learn the document from those two. Now it goes on, of course. Lo nichtav rachmana bevia. Okay, so let's take two others. Let's leave out sex. Alright, so we have left money and the document. Alright? Let's leave out sex and we'll learn sex from money and a document. In these two cases, money and a document, it is true that all three of these things are used as sources of acquisition. But money and documents are common sources of acquisition. They're used all the time, every day. Sex? Rarely. Very unusual circumstance that sex is used for a lot of things. But sex is not used for acquisition except in two cases. Marriage and the levirate marriage. So it's a very unusual case. So therefore you can't learn common forms of acquisition, you can't learn then an uncommon form of acquisition. Right? So that's no good. Well, that's not the end of it, because we've now tried two of them. There's one left. Lo nitav rachmana b'chesed. Let the Torah not tell us about money. Right? Let the Torah not tell us about money. To take from the other, I can learn from the other two. Learn from the other document in sex. Oh, in those two of the document in sex, each of them involves a situation where, in fact, they can be used against the woman's will. Very interesting. Very interesting is an issue of law. Both the document and sex could, in theory, be used against the woman's will. How? In divorce. The Torah says the chatat says that he took. Right? Says that he shall write to her a bill of divorcement if he finds in her something unseemly, of love of her. He shall write for her a book of divorcement. Right? At least in theory, as far as the Torah is concerned, we went into this last time to show that as the law was developed by the rabbis did away with this problem. But at least as far as the Torah goes, he could say, I'm sorry, here's your bill of divorcement, goodbye. Okay? The rabbis protect her by saying that she has to accept the divorce. But at least as far as the Torah itself goes, what's written in the Torah, it appears that he can do it against her will. Also true as far as the levirate marriage goes. He has to sleep with her. What if she doesn't want it? Doesn't give her an out. Does not give her an out. Of course, that's later solved also. The whole levirate marriage thing is outlawed. Rabbis themselves outlawed in the Talmud. So each of these things is dealt with in time. But as far as the Torah is concerned, each of these two forms of acquisition, in effect, are forms of acquisition which, in certain circumstances, do not require her consent. Right? Now, that's different. Money is always used with consent. Somebody has to consent to give, somebody has to consent to take. That's money. Money is unique, therefore you can't learn money from these other two. So what are we left with? We are left with the need to have three verses to learn the three forms of acquisition. Okay? It's an interesting progress, I think. You'll see this goes on a little bit more with some more logical arguments that go in a certain direction. And we'll be bringing up another subject very shortly. But the bottom line appears to be that the structure of marriage and the structure of kinyan is such that there are three. Those three cannot be derived one from the other, nor one from two. They cannot be derived simply logically from certain verses that are not directly saying what they appear to be saying. And in fact, you need three verses.
Does that mean that there are three types of marriages?
No. It means that there are three ways to acquire, or there are three ways to create the transition between non-marriage and marriage. It doesn't mean that there are three marriages, there are just three ways to do it. Okay?
One better than the other.
In fact, the answer is yes and no. You have to have all three, but if you don't have all three, one is sufficient. Correct. So if you have to have all three, according to the rabbis, you have to have all three. You have to have all three. But if you don't have all three, one is sufficient.
Can I ask you a question about that, for people who perhaps don't have
200 How does that answer the question?
No,
the 200 isn't meant for divorce, not for marriage.
I understand that, but you prudently said, it's like the good faith appearance of it in the starting point, so that it's not the end point, it's there.
Okay.
And then it becomes a fit.
Just as an aside, Rommel used the Talmud in his book to explain Mormonism, marriage, and especially polygamy and the outlaw of polygamy.
Yes. Very good. God bless him. May this person win. Okay. Now, I wanted to at this point, take a little break from the Talmudic text and show you the way in which this material is discussed by Maimonides in his Mishneh Torah. Maimonides, as he frequently does, both summarizes and puts in context the laws that we learn in atonement. One section of the Mishneh Torah, which is the Code of Jewish Law, this is published in 1179, written in Hebrew. Purpose of writing this code is that there wasn't a universal code of Jewish law. There were certain attempts made to provide things like codes, and Maimonides felt that it would be more useful to have a full code so that you wouldn't necessarily then get lost in the Talmudic discussions and you'd know what the law was. So that's what he wrote the Mishneh Torah. It was comprehensive. It covers all the areas of the law. And that may seem obvious, but the Shulchan Aruch, for example, is not comprehensive. Shulchan Aruch, which was written in the 16th century, only covers the areas of law that were relevant in the 16th century. Maimonides covers all areas of law, whether they were relevant or not. Okay? So that what is not relevant, for example, material in much of the book of Leviticus, the book of Numbers, about sacrifices. You have none of that in the Shulchan Aruch. You have complete discussion of that in my mind. Laws of political government, Jews had no sovereignty in the Middle Ages, but to have complete laws of government in their monarchies. So it's a comprehensive effort. And one of the values intellectually of reading the Mishneh Torah is that he also puts things in an intellectual context, in a context frequently of jurisprudence, the history of jurisprudence. Why are there laws like this? Or Maimonides engages in what we would call the history of religions, or what I call the history of religions. His basic approach is a historical approach, and either he has clear evidence or he has some evidence which he uses to put things in a historical context. So here at the beginning of the laws of marriage, Hilchot Ishut, actually Ishut doesn't only mean marriage, it can also mean sex. So it can either mean one or the other. I think in the context it means laws of marriage. He begins it by saying, Yesh bichlalan arba mitzvot. There are in these laws four mitzvot, meaning four mitzvot of the Torah. Shtei mitzvot aseh, two positive commandments, u'shtei mitzvot lo taseh, and two negative commandments. V'zehu pratam, and this is their detail. Aleph, lisa isha bichtufa ukidushin, that a woman, that one should marry a woman, bichtufah, with a ketubah, and with kiddushin, and with kiddushin. Of course, he doesn't say what that means. We don't know from this exactly what is a ketubah, and we don't know what kiddushin are from what he has said so far, but that one should not have sexual intercourse with a woman without a ketubah and without kiddushin. Very interesting statement. This, therefore, Maimonides is saying the fact that non-marital sex at any time is prohibited by the Torah. That's why you can see he's drawing certain conclusions, and that's why Maimonides is very interesting, because you can read a lot of things in the literature that don't seem to say this.
Maybe also where it's unpopular.
I should be as unpopular as
you. If the Torah is an act of marriage, then what comes first?
Biyah. I mean, you can have biyah for the sake of marriage.
For the sake?
Sure.
Does
yes.
Fall into that?
Of course. Oh, yes. Okay. That would, because we know, and he will tell us, that one of the ways of having kiddushin is through biyah. It's through sexual intercourse. Gimel. Shalo yinah she'er tushut ve'ona. A man must provide for his wife's food, clothing, and sex. Four, lifrot v'lirvot mimena, to be fruitful and multiply from her. Okay? So that's his basic introduction before he gets to the laws. Now he gets to the law Allah. Kodan matan Torah, before the giving of the Torah, haya adam pogea isha bashuk, a man would meet a woman in the marketplace. Imratza hu vehi lisa ota, if he and she wanted literally to get married to her, in other words, if they agreed to get married, machnitza letoch beto uvoala beino levein atzmo v'tihiyah lo v'isha, he could bring her into his home, have sex with her between him and himself. In other words, nobody else had to know about this. V'tiyelo le'isha, and she would be his wife. Kevan shenitna Torah, with the giving of the Torah, nitzavu Yisrael, Israel was commanded, She'im yirtzeh ha'ish lisa isha, that if a man wishes to marry a woman, yikneh ota techila bifnei edim, he must acquire her before witnesses. Yachakach tihyeh lo leisha, and afterwards, therefore, she will become his wife. She'ne'amar ki yikach ish isha uva eleha. Right, as we read in the Torah, when a man acquires a wife and he comes to her, in other words, there has to be an act of acquisition, which is part of the process. And the notion of acquisition here is that it is witnessed. You see, what he is trying to do is to say that marriage by the Torah is taken out of the context of a private agreement and made a public agreement. It becomes a part of the social conventions of the society and is regulated by the society, because marriage is a social institution and not a private arrangement. And that is the force then of acts of kinyan. An act of kinyan is a witness act. And however we arrange it, basically, it is taken out of the private. Marriage is seen not as a private activity, but as a public one, one that is publicly acknowledged. And the point is a very fascinating point, because, you know, number one, it goes against the grain of modern, of a lot of our modern thinking, or at least, I shouldn't say modern, because today actually people are returning to this idea. For a long time, it was very common among sort of progressive thought to say that we don't need a ceremony. We don't need anything like that because it's private between us and that is what counts. That's where the real marriage is, isn't something private. This is the opposite. In fact, we've come around to that. We're back in the age of big marriages. Even though ever so many people are living together before that, still, the marriage, the public marriage, has again become important, whereas for a number of years that wasn't the case. Things were going in the opposite direction. Okay? Let me just go a little bit further. Now, bets. Number two. The likuchim elu mitzvat asei shel torahim. These forms of acquisition are positive commandments of the Torah. Ubiachad mishlosha devarim elu ha'isha niknet. And through one of these things a woman is acquired. The chesed, Obishtar, Obivina, through money, through a document, or through sexual intercourse. So all of this is straight from what we studied, so none of this should be surprising. Listen to what he says next now. Vivia Obishtar Minatara. The Chesef Midivre Sofri. Sexual intercourse and the document come from the Torah. Money is rabbinic legislation. So in other words, what he seems to be saying now is that the notion of acquisition comes from the Torah, but the forms of acquisition, two of them come from the Torah and one comes from the rabbis. The likuchim elu hein hamikra'im kiddushin al erusin. These forms of acquisition are called kiddushin or erusin. The chol makom, in every place. The isha shenikneit beachad migimel dvarim elu, hi anikreit mikudeshet omes meureset. And a woman who is acquired by one of these three methods is called mikudeshet or meureset. Those are the Hebrew terms for a woman who is in that state of attachment. Okay. Now, the very strange thing here is that we have spent all this time finding three biblical verses.
Right. So he's not impressed with the literal.
And coming to the conclusion, therefore, that there are three sources in the Torah for the three forms of acquisition. And Maimonides, no sooner does he give you the feeling that he's going to say exactly the same thing, he pulls back on one of them. He says two yes are from the Torah, the third is rabbinic. Now, just give you, we're running out of time, so I can't go into this a lot, but let me read to you one of the commentaries here on Maimonides, Kesef Mishneh. This is a commentary written by Rabbi Yosef Kara, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. Be'achad mishlosha dvarim, he's quoting Maimonides, through one of three methods. Bezi'ah, bishtar, mina Torah, bekesef, midivrei sofrim. So this is what he's commenting on. First two, sex and the document are from the Torah, and money is from the rabbis. Zedavar kasha. This is difficult. Heyach katav sha'akesef midivrei sofrim. How could he write that money is from the rabbis? Sha'arei lamdu kidushe kesef, because the rabbis themselves learned in the Talmud that money is of significance, as next kidushin, kicha miste ephron. Right? They learn kikach ish isha, the word lakachat, and lakachat in the acquisition of the field of Ephron by Abraham. They learn that in the Talmud, and those are both verses from the Torah. The chol davar in yomad be'achat miyud yemo midot. Indeed, they're using the method of gzeira shava, where there are two words in two different places. They are comparing those two words and learning from the use in one context about the use in another context. Alright? That's the classic methodology of Zera Shava. And the Kesef Mishneh says, the whole Navar and Yomad Me'achad Miyud Gimel Midot, everything learned from the 13 methods by which the Torah is interpreted. Havei Devar Torah. This should be considered to be the words of the Torah itself. Umasati katuv be'aramach shaharamach. I have found, written by Ramach, Rabbi Mordechai Kohen, the Hagotav, in one of his comments on Maimonides, he'id sh'Rabbeinu atzmo higia b'sifro u'shloshtan dvar Torah. He says that Maimonides himself corrected the text of the Mishneh Torah and changed it to the following, Shloshtan Davar Torah. The three of them are from the Torah. The Gamani Matzati came b'tshuvot Rav Avraham Denau. I also found this in the responsa of Rabbi Abraham, the son of Maimonides. Rabbi Abraham, the son of Maimonides, followed Maimonides' footsteps in Cairo, and in one of his responses, he said the same thing. The Maimonides took, there were three methods from the Torah. Mikol makom lini reshe ene edutochem. But the Kesef Mishneh says that I don't think what the Ramach, or what Mordechai Kohen said, or his son said, is correct. And he then goes on to explain how it could be that Maimonides reasoned that two are from the Torah and one is not from the Torah. And I just point this out to you because this then is the source of volumes of literature. What Maimonides could have meant by this. Whether there was something peculiar and different about that interpretation, kicha, kicha, as opposed to the other two interpretations, and he felt that the methodology used was different enough to classify it as being rabbinic and not from the Torah itself, perhaps that was what was happening. Or perhaps not.
The Welsh Torah, that time, today, we have Welsh Torah to be careful.
It's a promissory note.
Right.
And it could be canceled.
Right. I didn't mean that then.
What was then? It wasn't at the same time.
No.
So what wouldn't be a bond?
No, no, it wouldn't be a bond. And those.
It would be a deal agreement?
It meant an agreement. Correct. It meant a contract. Or we would say it was there in the monarchy, I think.
So it couldn't be that the Welsh style had the double meaning?
No, no.
Like today we
are? I don't think there's any incident of that. In either the Bible or the Talmud.
Because an Israel Shtar could be a bond,
yes,
could be a contract,
and
could be real
and
money.
It could be real money, correct. A paper money is called
a
Shtar.
That's exactly right. Which is a bond, it's translation.
Correct.
It's a cover.
It really is a bond, it's correct, because the real money doesn't really,
right,
has no value.
Right.
It simply is standing for something that
the
might bond have value or something like that, correct. But no, that's not in the Talmud. You see, that Maimonides is fascinating here. It's perplexing. And it's hard to understand. If we had more time, we could look at a variety of commentaries on Maimonides here to try to solve this problem, for better or for worse. But you see that Maimonides does put this in a general context of law and the nature of marriage law, and that it takes it out of the context of the individual experience and makes it a public agreement. And that's the significance then of forms of acquisition.
Did Maimonides
know anything specific about the rabbis and something that happened, something
that
came before them,
that might have made them do something specific about money at that time that he had
access to that made him,
you know?
All I can say is that I don't know that he did.
I mean, so I'm wondering whether or not anything
as far as I know, none of the commentators point that out. No, what the commentators tend to do is that they point to different places in the Talmud where one or more of these forms is given more force. Because you yourself, I'm sure, wonder, even though we found these biblical verses, have the rabbis found these verses in order to prove something that in fact they are manufacturing? And in a way, Maimonides is leading you in this direction too, that the whole idea in marriage law is to create procedure. And procedure is the essence of where the law is going. And are they creating procedure, or did their procedure already exist? That they are trying to pin on biblical verses, but they are not really deriving it from that? And maybe, in fact, it doesn't come from that? But we're always left wondering. So much so that while it appears on the one hand as if he proves something from biblical texts, you can see that even Maimonides himself is not satisfied with that proof. He's satisfied with it in two of the three cases and not in three. So I think that we have almost an intuitive sense that this is always problematic. And here you can see that to him that wasn't so problematic.
I just wanted to go back to that very discrete difference before and after the giving of the Torah. We view marriage as having a three-party contract. It's the two people getting married and the state. And the state has an interest in the marriage, and that's why it acts as a party to it for a variety of reasons. And it seems as if that reasoning is being applied to the giving of the Torah, that the giving of the Torah in fact creates a state.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
correct.
A state
that's
with
correct.
An interest in the social structure.
Correct. It's a political philosophy. You're exactly right.
The
exactly
party to
yep.
the process, so that the witnessing is in fact the stand-in for what we would call the state.
That's correct. That's correct. Of course, you're right to say that this is creating the state, as it were. It's creating the policy of the people. The people is partly made by the reality of the contract, right? As in any state, we ask what is the social contract or the written contract that expresses the social contract. And here, of course, this is a divine contract. So to some extent, that piece is a little bit different. It's not, but functionally, the divine contract works
as in other states, another kind of contract will also work, has some of, and to a great degree perhaps, the same functional utility.
Well, then the witnesses are witnesses on behalf of God.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. The witnesses then, it's an interesting issue to think of this theologically, to what extent, as you said, there are three parties to this, to the contract. How many parties are there to this one? And I'm not exactly sure I know the answer to that, because the temptation is to say a third party is God. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the temptation. In all Christian literature, you would find that. In all Christian readings of the Bible, you would find that. One of the interesting things is that here we are, we've read not a lot of Kiddushin. I read the Masechet, and I don't think it ever says that God is a party to it. There is much Midrash that does say it. Midrash does say that. For example, Midrash says, and I've used this frequently at wedding ceremonies, Ish and Isha. Each of those words has two letters in common and one letter different. Two letters in common are Aleph and Shin. Aleph and Shin spell Ish. Ish is fire. You bring a woman and a man together, you have fire. You have desire, instinct, you have all those things that are libidinous, that make it all happen. And of course you bring the two of them together and you put the yud together with the hay and you have the name of God. So marriage is a combination of that which is natural and that which is supernatural. Okay? So you have that very much in the Midrash. The Midrash is there, but you don't have it here. At least you haven't seen it as much as my computer head is working. I don't remember seeing it either. Whereas you do have that much more explicitly in childbearing. But there are three parties to the creation of the child. The Father, the Mother, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and the Holy One blessed be He. Okay? God is an intimate party to creation. But this is actually different. And it's partly because it's different that you can undo it, too. You can undo it. Since it's a contract entered into by two people, it is a contract that could be ended. Similarly, the way contracts can be ended. It could be continued, number two.
One of the charities